Hey, listener, how's things? This is the Football Diary podcast, another smaller set of Premier League fixtures this week. And I've got both Miles and Dave here to work through them all. Arsenal thrashing Palace, and Ivan Toney inspired Brentford beating Forest. Liverpool putting four past Bournemouth to name but three. But it's at Bramall Lane where I think we'll start. A 2-2 draw between Sheffield United and West Ham. And a mad ending to the game, Miles. Two red cards, a penalty given, a penalty perhaps shouldn't have been given. And another one completely ignored, all after 90 minutes as well, this was. But still, you've got to say, it's probably a deserved point for Sheffield United, wouldn't you think?
It's a huge point for Sheffield United as well. I think while they're trying to pick up a bit of momentum, they're obviously going to do a bit of business in January to help try and carry them through, as we saw in this game with an impactful debut. Yeah, it's massive for them. And it's good that actually in a weekend where there's not a lot of Premier League football, each game gave us some quite exciting points to talk about. This one really lived up to any potential. But yeah, very chaotic end to the game. But that's what fans want to see, really.
Yeah, I kind of think that Sheffield United probably had the majority of the best play up until West Ham broke the deadlock, really, which was a shame for them. It was a bit of a sucker punch to the Blades. But Dave, what did you make of it? Sheffield United fighting went the way back into the game. Ollie McBurnie's penalty was the latest goal in Premier League history as well, because it was so deep into injury time. And he's the first Sheffield United player to score in four consecutive top flight games, I hear, as well. So it was a big one for them. And obviously, Ben Brereton-Diaz with his debut Premier League goal. There's quite a few positives to take from it for them, wasn't there?
Oh, definitely. I think the way they actually approached the game itself, considering they're obviously lacking a bit of confidence, you know, that's very evident, I think, especially in terms of the chances that they're getting and the chances that they're not putting away. I thought Brereton-Diaz had a really positive debut, got himself into good areas, obviously took his goal really well. I thought the starting lineup was a bit of a strange one. They played, obviously got quite a few youngsters in that side, and the lack of kind of a senior sort of striker or forward man is actually, you know, it's hurting them really. You've got, for instance, James McAtee, I think, is their best player by a long stretch. I thought he had a really good game, talent-wise. But he's creating opportunities for players who, you know, there's no real clinical nature to this team, and that's been for the whole season. And it was emphasised, I think it was on the stroke of half-time, they had a really good opportunity, and Brereton-Diaz was in a nice pocket at the back post. I think it's Osula, is it? Who had the opportunity just it would have been a goal-scoring opportunity. If it was a perfect way to pass, it was a simple pass, it would have been a shot on goal, and it would have been a very presentable opportunity. And he decided to cut back inside for that youthful sort of naivety, took an opportunity onside it and just went out for a corner. It's instances like that that are really kind of costing them. In this league, you won't get away with it. And maybe in the Championship, leagues lower down the table, lower down the pyramid, you know, you will get more opportunities like that time and again, but you don't get those opportunities very often. But we mentioned James McAtee, but in this game, he was, you know, really, I thought he played really well, to be honest. I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword because he's a player that's got so much talent. I think he could be more selfish. We've seen him score goals. He's got the ability to do that. But I think he feels like the onus is on him to create. And he played some great balls into the box, which they didn't really, they obviously didn't finish off. But I feel like he definitely got it in him to go and score more goals.
Yeah, well, they've had 58% of the possession in this game. And that's not the way they've been setting up this season at all. So that in itself is an improvement. 21 attempts at goal, but only 6 on target, Miles. Tells a story as well, doesn't it? As Dave was saying, slightly wasteful from Sheffield United. And we've given them some praise here by saying, you know, they deserve the point and, you know, telling the world that we think that, you know, they're playing better football and it's encouraging for them, but they're still rooted to the bottom of the Premier League. So that won't be any consolation to the fans, will it? What do you think they need to see now to be able to turn this season around? Is there any chance for them to turn it around as well?
I think there are some things that they can take from it. I think James talks about, Dave talks about the kind of all the focus being on McAtee, but with Brereton-Diaz coming in, that's another player that can be a bit of a creative force to kind of take some of that pressure off, and someone who's a bit more experienced and kind of gone out and done things in La Liga and internationally, as well as dominating the championship for a long time. That seems like a smart investment. And actually, his goal here was a really good bit of evidence of what he can bring to this team because he fought for it. It was really good to see him kind of putting that challenge in into the box, not giving up what looked like a bit of a lost cause at the time. Ward-Prowse probably should have done better, but he battled for it and took it really well. And I think that's an encouraging sign that actually Chris Wilder isn't just going to roll over and let them get relegated and build again from the championship. They've brought someone in January who could have a big impact, and I'm not convinced that that's all they'll do. I think they'll probably go out again. It's interesting with Sheffield United because we've seen them be one of the worst teams the Premier League has seen in a few of the fixtures, and under Heckenbottom, it looked like they were just doomed. And Wilder wasn't necessarily an appointment that inspired many because we saw how that finished last time and where he's been since. But it does still feel like the bottom of the table is still tight enough that teams can pull themselves out of it if they go through a successful run. And when you mention someone like McBurnie scoring 4 games in a row, that's what they need right now. Because it feels like a lot of players are letting them down slightly. Like Brewster getting sent off in this game. Such a weird player to me. Like, you look at how Dom Solanke's doing at Bournemouth, and they seem like really similar profiles of player. Came from a bigger club, lots of potential, impressed at youth level. And one of them has finally got their career back to where they wanted it, and in fact, maybe higher than a lot of us anticipated. And the other one, it's amazing that he's a Premier League player, it feels like. And that silly challenge at the end of the game that could have cost them everything, really, when they're chasing it still. I think Sheffield United need a bit of consistency and a bit of that quality to shine through and not give themselves up to those moments. They should have conceded a penalty after they equalised. If that had been given, what a ridiculous piece of defending it was. It is back turned to the ball and was wrestling with Bowen. It absolutely was a penalty. And those little moments could really cost them. They got away with one there, but you need them in a season. But there is something about Sheffield United. Defensively, they seem much more organised under Wilder. They held onto the ball much better in this game, and they have got creative players. They just need that clinical impact, like Dave said. So we'll see.
Yeah, that penalty decision that wasn't given on Bowen has been described as a body slam The Rock would have been proud of on social media, which I thought was quite funny. But I mean, the difference for me is Sheffield United are still a little bit of a patchwork team for me, Dave. I don't know if you agree, because I mean, their two main threats on this game were McAtee and Brereton Diaz, who are not going to be around for long, are they? Whereas you look at the likes of Burnley and Luton, and it's very much a team that's been fostered by their managers. But in this case, obviously, they're still trying to figure out their way of playing and suiting it to the Premier League. But Luton are fighting and they're doing it together. Sheffield United seem to be doing that quite late to the party, don't they? And I think that's probably what's going to cost them in the end, isn't it? That if they do turn around their form, it's too little too late in some ways.
They've definitely been handicapped, for sure. I think it's too little, like you mentioned. I think it is too little too late because there are a number of points adrift of safety at the net at the minute. I mean, you look at the teams above them, and the likes of Luton, obviously Burnley, have improved of late as well. I think it's a mountain to climb, let's be honest. But what is encouraging is they're not dispirited by it. I think the performance today showed that, that the character in there is, it's been top notch since Wilder's come in, especially. The attitude, is encouraging, and how they're performing at times is, I do feel like their performances are probably going under the radar a little bit. I think they're actually doing a lot better than what the results suggest, but it's been a case of them not taking their opportunities when they've had them. A bit, I think there's a few lapses of concentration and defending at times as well. We've seen it in the game today, and like you say, you get punished at this level, and if they can do some business in January, and obviously they've bought Brereton Diaz, and if they can get a couple more players in. The thing is, they were really quick coming into the season. They lost two or three key players, and then last season just didn't replace them, which you can't afford to do coming into like a league of this, with the strength of the Premier League. And it'll be interesting to see if they do manage to get anyone in. It's going to be a tough ask, let's be honest.
It's worth remembering though, like West Ham were building some momentum. They've flown up the league, so a point against West Ham is not a bad result for them at all. They also took a point from Villa at Villa Park. Like, they've had a couple of results recently that I don't think they would have been banking on. So there is some hope for them there. The sad thing is that game against Villa probably should have been 3 points for them. They conceded really late on. They probably could have conceded again in this game. So the confidence isn't quite there yet. And I think that's what Wilder will have to build on. Because if we are seeing games where they're dominating the ball, creating a lot of chances, that should tell them that there is a fighting chance for them there. But it seems like when they do get themselves into these winning positions, they don't expect to hold on to it for long enough, and then they end up throwing it away. So I don't know. I think that is a case of momentum needs to build, but it could.
Yeah. Two more teams we'll talk about next, which are also flirting with the bottom of the table, Brentford and Nottingham Forest. A 3-2 win for Brentford. A game which obviously was important for both teams to try and address form issues. Brentford in particular were going through a horrendous run of form. But the headline taker really is Ivan Toney, isn't it, on his return. He scored in this game, scored the equaliser to Forest's opening goal, made it 1-1. And he's not really making the headlines for the right reasons, is he, Miles? I mean, you watched the game, you had some colourful words to describe what you think of Ivan Toney. They made him captain for this game as well. So the spotlight was very much on him. But from some of the things he's saying, he's not becoming the most likeable player, is he?
No, it's really frustrating because his performance in this game was excellent. He got man of the match in this game. And for your first start in as long as it is, I think it was 267 days, that's huge for him. And the performance on the pitch should be what we talk about. But it feels like never has a player become so unlikable so fast. Obviously, yeah. When we found out about his ban, we were incredibly sympathetic on the podcast, as we should be. Because addiction is a horrible thing to battle, and we openly criticise how football we feel like is a bit of a poison chalice when it comes to betting because it encourages it. So we were in full support. But the way he's dealt with a lot of these situations is so questionable to me. And if I was a Brentford fan, I'd feel so conflicted over who is essentially your star player. Because, okay, when the charge came out, he talked about it and didn't seem to take any accountability for a lot of things and was passing the blame on a lot of areas, which was difficult. In the meantime, has talked very openly about how he wants to move to a big club, which I think is very risky thing to say about your current employers, particularly when they are supporting you through a really challenging time in your career. It's not the first time he's had comments. Obviously, there was that viral clip that went around a couple of years ago of him talking to a fan abroad saying that he played for Brentford. You've probably never heard of them because they're crap. And now we've got this moment where he's clearly angling for a move. He's hoping it's Arsenal or Liverpool, clearly. And even after the game, he was talking about, I manifested this. I knew we would win and I would score. So I manifested it. I made it happen. And it's great for me. And it was, I don't know, I find it a bit tiring. And for a player who has obviously gone through something quite difficult and come back and we're expecting big things of, a bit of humility is probably needed just to appease the fan base as well. And to show some gratitude for your manager and your club that have stuck by you. And like you said, made him captain in this game. So yeah, excellent performance from him on the pitch, but his conduct isn't endearing him to anyone. And the free kick, that was cheeky, wasn't it? The goalkeeper's lining the wall up and he moves not only the ball, but the spray to try and get away with it. The interviewer asked him about it after the game. He was like, yeah, I think you get a bit of leeway 1 yard either way. But after the ref sprayed, after the ref marked out where the ball should be placed and you can't move it from there. That's shocking. Apparently Forrest have written to PGMOL. But what good does that do? We've seen that so many times.
We'll get an apology probably, won't we? That's probably the limit of it.
But
cheeky is the word, mate. I think it's gamesmanship of the highest order, isn't it? And just trying to gain that minimal advantage, which, you know, worked in the end. But Dave, Thomas Frank was saying that Brentford evidently need Ivan Toney. And I think they were really desperate to make him feel like that was the case as well by giving him the armband. And he produced with a fantastic performance, as Miles was saying. But I mean, are you feeling the same way as Miles about Toney? Do you find it difficult as a non-Brentford supporter to like him? How would you feel if he played for your club? Because there's some players that do that, don't they? They kind of wind up the opposition and do things and say things to be abrasive. And you kind of think, well, I kind of like that. It's kind of what you want, that spike element to some players. Emi Martinez, as you're referencing today as well, is kind of one of those players who, you know, you want on your team. But is Toney that way for you, do you think, Dave?
I think it's a different kind of dislike of a player, though. For instance, take Bruno Fernandes, for instance, for United. I can understand why other teams, you know, will despise him because he's the sort of player who winds other teams up. You know, he's quite theatric with his antics. And whereas Toney, he's just got that air of arrogance about him. And, you know, you can tell that he thinks a lot of himself. You know, he knows he's good. Don't get me wrong, he's a great player, but that is, for me, it's a little bit more ugly for me than the other side of things. So you can understand why that will look a little bit ugly to some people looking on that. And I just don't think it shows him in a great light, to be honest. I think it's, you know, the performance himself, you could see them missed him massively. Coming into this game, I thought he made a great impact. The way that he linked up play, created chances for his teammates, something that they've really struggled to do, especially since Mbeumo's obviously not been in the team as well. They've missed both of those players massively. So you can understand why it's riled in people up a little bit with the way he's acted.
Do you know what, though? The fundamental difference between what you're saying, Mike, about players like Emi Martinez and Bruno Fernandes and Tony is they are doing it in support of their club against the opposition, whereas Tony seems to be doing it against his own club. That's never going to endear yourself to anyone. And if I was a club like Arsenal now, who are looking for a player of that sort of calibre and quality, I'd be thinking about the harmony of the dressing room, because Arteta has clearly fostered an excellent spirit amongst that Arsenal camp. I'm wondering, is this the sort of character that is going to have the right impact on and off the pitch? And the answer right now seems to be no. Because, okay, then what? Just totally start talking about how it's his dream to play for Real Madrid all of a sudden. And I find it a very odd tactic to take when a club has supported you so openly through a really challenging period in your career. I think it's baffling, to be honest.
Well, we talked about how Brentford had coped without Tony, didn't we? And I know, obviously, Thomas Frank rates him very highly, said that, you know, they need him. But I thought they coped admirably for the most part with Bruno and Johan Visser as well, with goals. But question for you, Miles, have we seen a Neil Mopé redemption arc here? He's prolific at the minute, isn't he? But I mean, this goal was contentious from what I could tell, but he deserved it because he played pretty well, didn't he?
I thought it was a superb goal. His first touch was excellent. And the way he took it on his left foot into the corner was fantastic. Even Tony, when they asked him about this after the game, he was like, yeah, he does it in training. I'm glad that me and Winning can form a partnership. But you could tell even he was a bit like, yeah, I didn't see that one coming, I'll be honest. It was ridiculous. But it would be, I was going to say it'd be nice for him, but he's a bit of a sod as well. He's another one that you don't really like as an opposition. But at least he's doing it because he's passionate. His feels like a more positive kind of,
yeah,
I don't know, negativity.
Positive kind of negativity. Yeah, I think you that's what I'm trying to sort of get across with some of these other, should we call them shithouses in teams, is that it tends to be for the good of the team. And I think Mopé definitely falls into that camp. Whether you like his style of play or not, he's coming back into some form, and you know, it might be a redemption arc for him after all. But moving on to another game, I'm going to focus on Arsenal briefly. They dispatched Crystal Palace 5-0. It was a very comfortable game, and Palace fans were pretty angry afterwards, weren't they? Once again, towards the mediocrity of the performance. I think 5-0 did flatter Arsenal, but I think one thing that stood out for me, Dave, was just Gabriel Martinelli's impact off the bench. And he's not quite hit the heights this season that he did the previous season, and not many players have for Arsenal, to be fair. There's a few in that midfield and that attack that just aren't performing as well or scoring as many as they did. But Martinelli was electric once he came on, wasn't it? There was some comparisons in some quarters. I think it might have been from Arsenal fans, to be fair, comparing him to Thierry Henry. I don't know if I would go that far, but he was very impressive again, wasn't he, in this game?
I think how the game was at that point, I think it was perfect for him. I think how Arsenal decided to set up, obviously they went with Trossard, who for me, I think he's just better in linking up play in those tight spaces. And I just think he operates better in that sort of game. But as soon as he came in, it was the perfect time in the game, when obviously Arsenal were quite comfortable ahead in the game, so there was space in behind for him to operate in. He took his two goals brilliantly, particularly the first one. Thought it was an outstanding finish. But he's always that sort of player that's what Arsenal do have his options, like him and Trossard. They're two very different players in how they play, but they've also got always got that different avenue to go down to affect a game. They're missing that number nine that they desperately want, who can obviously guarantee them goals game after game, which they don't have at the minute. But they do have a lot of options, and that's something that they kind of use to their full, you know, devastation, really, in terms of how they took Palace apart. They had no answer, and, you know, as bad as Palace were at times in this game, Arsenal actually made it look so easy. I think in the first half, they didn't probably play as well as they could have, which sounds ridiculous because they made it really comfortable for themselves. But the first two goals, they didn't really create a great deal, aside from the first two set pieces, which obviously they scored from. So it's a positive. You can't really obviously argue with the result as an Arsenal fan. I think it's encouraging for them going forward. Obviously, they've had a few setbacks in the last few weeks, so 5-0, we can't do any better than that, really.
No, well, it was a game that I think just injected a bit more energy into Arsenal's season. I think they needed it at this moment in time, and Crystal Palace were probably the best opposition to kind of find that kind of form from, wasn't it? As you say, Martinelli came on at a time when they were pretty much defeated, but his goals were pretty much like carbon copies, weren't they? Deep into injury time too, which was interesting because I feel like that's what Arsenal have missed this season, that kind of goal, that kind of directness as well. What did you make of their performance, Miles? Do you think they were worthy of a 5-0 win? And do you think this will do them the good they need really to stay in the title race?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, Martinelli will have really benefited from that because he will have seen that there's a lot of talk about his form. You'll have seen that there's an open conversation about where Arsenal's goals are going to come from. And who better to do that than running at a tired Nathaniel Clyne in 2024, yeah, if we're honest. But feel a bit for him because he slipped for Trossard's goal as well, didn't he? He was having a horrible afternoon. It's interesting with Arsenal because if you look, they have scored more goals from set pieces than any other team in the Premier League this year, which I'll be honest, I find an amazing stat because I feel like every time I watch Arsenal play, all I see is Trossard hitting the first man from a corner and managed to get two goals here. And I wonder if there's something to be said of, there's a lot of talk about how the route to goal last year was Martinelli and Saka cutting inside and defenders have really limited them to doing that. But I wonder if actually that means that they win far more corners from the wings because their wingers are being marked so heavily by the fullback, and then they're capitalising on those set piece opportunities. So they're not really losing the goals from the team. They've just found a different avenue of getting them. And that's a really encouraging thing for Arteta to see. Gabriel obviously did really well with both. The second one, I wondered whether it was going to get pulled for a foul on the keeper because it looked like Ben White had kind of backed into the keeper. But even still, it was a good instinctual finish. So, yeah, I think Arsenal will take a lot of encouragement from this, particularly when they've seen City get a result last week and Liverpool obviously went on to win quite convincingly this afternoon as well. They needed to keep themselves in touching distance. And we anticipate that it's going to be a quieter January than maybe we thought Arsenal would go in for, just based on financial restrictions. So seeing goals come from across the pitch, seeing Trossard to kind of take his opportunity, and hopefully a bit of a bounce back to form for Martinelli will be huge for them as the season goes on.
Well, there were three Gabriels on the pitch and they all performed pretty well for Arsenal in this game. Jesus obviously returning, got an assist as well for Trossard's goal.
It was a lovely
pass. Yeah, really good to see a few players coming back to form. But I think the defender, Gabriel, Dave, is probably the one that doesn't get talked about enough. And Miles, you highlighted rightly, the set pieces in this game were superb, weren't they? They were spot on. And Gabriel's a clear target for them, Dave. And I think it's underrated how many goals he scores from those kind of positions, Gabriel. He's, on his day, one of the best defenders in the league, isn't he, at least? If not better than that. I think I was really impressed with him. I always see Saliba as kind of the stronger partner of the two. But he's very impressive, isn't he, as a defender?
I think he's a great defender. If I'm honest, I think he's the worst defender of the two of them. I do rate Saliba a little bit high, but I think in terms of in the opposition penalty area, I think Gabriel is, you know, he's outstanding. Shows, you know, amount of, you kind of expect him to win a lot of headers in the penalty area, and how Arsenal have actually improved over the last couple of years from set pieces. And they brought Man City's. Mikel Arteta brought Man City as one of the coaches from the one who's now set piece coach at Arsenal, and they've massively improved since. And I think it helps also that you've got two so really imposing defenders in the opposition box, Saliba and Gabriel, both, you know, that it's no surprise that they actually get quite a few goals from corners now. And I think there's plenty of room for improvement as a defender. I think there are times when he's been caught out and positionally, I think his decision making at times isn't great, but he's definitely showing in terms of improvement. It's, you know, the signs are there.
Yeah, Arsenal seem to be back on track, don't they, Miles? I mean, what were you going to say about their performance here? Anything you want to add to that?
More, I thought it'd be worth looking at Crystal Palace for a moment, actually, because I think you talked about how the fans seemed quite downbeat about their recent run of form. And there's obviously a lot of talk about what happens at the end of this season, and if not
Yeah.
before. And Palace are such an interesting club to me because it seems like they've got a ceiling and you can't see a way of them cracking it, which is weird because a team like Brighton, you'd put them on a bit of a par in terms of resources, and they managed to kick on last year and get themselves into Europe. Can you ever see Palace doing something like that? Along with that, you can also never see Palace going down. So it feels like a bit of a limbo
Yeah.
existence. And obviously with Hodgson there, he has a lot of respect from the club and its fan base, but it feels like that kind of journey is coming to an end. And I'm really interested by what Palace do next. Because in this game, let's be honest, they performed incredibly poorly. Any chances that they had were purely because of the absolute class of Eberechi Eze, that he kind of just pulls something out of nothing every now and again.
Yeah.
Is there a better person to take this team forward? Obviously, there's a lot of talk that after Hodgson, they'll be looking at either Steve Cooper or Michael Carrick, which could be really interesting appointments, actually. And if Palace are looking to play better football, maybe that's not a smart, maybe that's not the most stupid thing we've heard, and actually it might be smarter to do that sooner rather than later.
Okay. Well, there's one that's available, isn't there? So that's the question I think that's being asked. And the fans had the banner in the stadium. Did you see it? Wasted potential on and off the pitch, they were saying. Weak decisions taking us backwards. And I think by weak decisions, I think they're probably referring to the fact that Hodgson's still there beyond that remit of keeping them in the league last season. And I think
Because
you're right. Palace fans are frustrated because they are in that weird limbo of the Premier League mid-table area where they're going to be somewhere between what, maybe 10th and 15th come the end of the season, which is a weird place to be because you're still in the Premier League, but there's no real hope of doing anything other than winning one, losing one, drawing one, and just keep repeating that cycle. But I think the frustration lies with the fact that some of the players there are really, really good potential and they're going to lose them if they don't perform better and aim higher, I think, essentially.
I think it's really telling about the kind of nervousness around clubs of that sort of level of what dropping out the league could do to them. Because if you look back, I think we said at the time we were really surprised that they got rid of Patrick Vieira, because they were on a terrible run of form, but they had this really favourable run of fixtures when Hodgson first came in that we estimate that Vieira probably would have got something out of as well. And actually, long term, it looked like he was getting things right. Like he'd got the best out of a few players. And I wonder if actually that young coach that was trying to push them forward, it would have been smarter to stick with them. But they were just so scared of the idea of dropping out of the league that they just panicked and did something. And now it feels like they're just going to go back and forth. They had a young, exciting coach who moved them forward a little bit. They got a bit nervous, got rid of him, brought in someone experienced. That's now not working for them anymore because they can't kick on. So what they're going to do now, they're going to move to a more progressive manager who's going to get them to kick on for a little bit. There'll be a rocky patch. And then what do they do? Do they get rid of them and then move backwards again? And that feels like such a weird cycle for Palace to be in. Have we ever seen Crystal Palace with consistently good young players in the squad to the level of Mark Guéhi, Tariq Mitchell, Michael Olyse, Eberechi Eze? We always knew them as the club that were really thriving off Will Zaha. But actually now, you are right, Mike. There is a core of players there that could really kick on in their careers. And right now, it doesn't feel like Palace are providing the opportunity or the platform for them to flourish. If I was Eze or Olise in particular, and I can see clubs like Man City coming in for me, I know I'm not going to get that much game time, but I'm going to get better coaching under Guardiola than I'm getting right now. And it's sad to say that about Hodgson. It's someone that I respect massively in the game, and I think he's been incredibly influential. But I think the time has come where Palace have got to start assessing what is their long-term goal here. Because it can't just be to just sit in 15th. Because what's the point as a Crystal Palace fan for that?
It's financial security. I think that's the way that the owners will look at it, and
Feels
they'll
like
take
it.
that over struggling in the championship. But you're right, that lack of ambition is going to cost them ultimately because these players are going to go. They're not going to stick around and see if Palace can break into the top 10 because they've got ambitions beyond breaking into the top 10, haven't they, at
Yeah,
the
of
end of the day?
course.
So, yeah, it's an interesting one, especially when you think of Elise as well, the kind of clubs that are coming in for him, not just here, but abroad as well. The fact that he could break into the France first team in the next 12 months, that's incredible. Or England, of course,
I
which
think
is,
him and Eze are gone in the summer. I think they both will go at this rate.
Which
I
would be a
think
shame because you're rooting for clubs like Crystal Palace to
100%.
step to that next level, but they've kind of brought it on themselves, really, though.
Feels like it.
I think it must be frustrating as a Palace player, because especially as one of the younger players coming in, because you get brought in and then you think, oh, you know, this is great, you're developing yourself, but then they've still got the likes of Jordan Ayew and Will Hughes in the squad. It feels like they've been around forever. And
I also feel like Will Hughes is 16 still, though, somehow. Young prospect forever.
It feels like Palace have been doing this for years. They keep these players in and around the squad, which is absolutely fine, but they're still in the first 11, which feels like they should be phased out after a while. Obviously, Edouard's been in and out of the team. Obviously, had his injury problems. Obviously, did play again this week. Elise, you know, was unavailable again. And it doesn't actually feel like Elise and Eze have actually played together that much this season. When Elise has been available, Eze hasn't. So it's kind of been one or the other, which I think has not affected, obviously not done them any favours in terms of going forwards. And there's just a lack of stability in that team, massively, for me.
Yeah, it's the unknown, isn't it? The unknown about what's going to happen beyond Roy Hodgson being at the club, who they bring in, what kind of style of football they play and where they aim is all going to shape, I think, Palace's future. But yeah, I'll move on quickly from that to Liverpool. The only other game we haven't discussed so far that's been played as we record, and they beat Bournemouth 4-0 in a pretty routine victory, I think it's fair to say. Quite difficult conditions. It was pretty stormy there, wasn't it? Mm. But two goals for Darwin Núñez, two goals for Diogo Jota. Salah, obviously nowhere near the team because he's been at AFCON. Is this a sign of how they could cope without him, do you think, Miles?
I think it could be, actually, because weirdly, I know it's a much smaller sample size, but Liverpool's win percentage without Salah is actually higher than with it, which is a bizarre thing to think. And obviously, he picked up a bit of an injury in AFCON the other day, which will be worrying for fans. But Núñez and Jota are both up to 7 goals in the league now, with 2 each in this game. There were moments where we saw proper chaotic Darwin Núñez, and then we saw the moments where he's clinical, and that seems to be his season so far. We never know whether we're going to get the best of him or not. But this is a really impressive result, because Bournemouth, we've seen a real rise in their game and their form has really improved. So to be without Trent, to be without Salah and win so comprehensively, I think once it was 2 or 3, Bournemouth didn't really have anything to do and they kind of gave up almost, and Liverpool were clinical enough to pick them up. So yeah, an excellent result for them and one that they will have been really proud of, seeing City obviously chasing them down and Arsenal winning earlier in the day. They needed it, didn't they?
I actually thought it'd be a lot tougher game than what it proved to be. I actually thought Bournemouth would probably potentially get something like this. And I think in terms of the actual line itself, obviously, we're missing Trent. And obviously, I thought it would be a lot of the game. I think Bournemouth actually will feel a little bit disappointed in their performance. I thought there were moments where they could have got at Liverpool, especially in the final third, they just looked like a shadow of themselves. I think there's a lot, actually. With the lack of actually shots on goal that they had in this game. In the last 3 games before this, they averaged 19 shots in the game. And in the last game before that, they had 24 shots versus Spurs, which is ridiculous in a game away.
It's true that the Bournemouth performance wasn't as good as we might have anticipated, considering where they've been. But I actually think that defensively as well, Liverpool were really strong. Like Konate, this is the kind of centre-back that Liverpool thought they were getting with him. He's obviously had difficulties with injuries and a bit of inconsistency at times. But that partnership of Van Dijk and Konate, that is up there with the best of the world right now, isn't it? And he managed to kind of put out any supply that Bournemouth tried to put into Solanke. He couldn't get involved in the game. He was really, really strong, I thought. The pair of them, of course, but we expect that of Van Dijk, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, Konate came in actually with a bit of a history of an injury record, actually, when he first came in. I think there was some doubt about that. And I think it's actually Van Dijk who's probably missed more games than him together as a partnership. But you're right, when they're together, you know, they're so imperious. And I don't think there's actually many better partnerships in the world. I think they're right up there, like you mentioned. I think those two and probably Gabriel and Saliba this season have been outstanding as well. There's not much between those two partnerships for me. I think that
all Torres and Conte.
Oh, yeah. All that. We'll see how the second half of the season goes.
Not to bring the tone down, and it feels like every week we've got something that we've got to talk about. Obviously, last week we had a really nice conversation on our part, I think, about the current state of football's misogyny. And it was good for us to be able to vocalize our thoughts on that because it's something that seems to be infecting the game in a horrible way. And then this week, we've had another issue brought up where obviously the Udinese AC Milan game got called off after 10 minutes because of the racist abuse that AC Milan goalkeeper Mike Maignan was receiving. Every goal kick he was going to take, he could hear abuse from the crowd, and the game got abandoned. And obviously in England as well, in the Coventry Sheffield Wednesday game, there was instance of Casey Palmer receiving similar abuse. Dave, we've talked about stuff of this nature so many times on and off mic. It's something that has been a problem within football for as long as the game's been on. And it feels like every time we take steps forward, fan base is bringing it back down again, sadly. And the latest talk from Infantino was that FIFA and football cannot accept these things, and that although he's really happy that the three-step plan of pausing the game, pausing again, and then abandoning is working to a degree of at least taking the players out of that firing line, it's not solving the problem. And his view was that education needs to happen earlier in schools, football needs to be more united, and actually, he suggested that from now on, examples of racism within a fan base would result in a forfeit of the game from the team whose fans were subjecting other players' opposition to this racist abuse. Now, in theory, it's not the worst idea, I think. I understand the logic behind it, and I think that you need to put something into place that will deter fans from taking part. And the sad truth of football and life is that the impact that it has on another human being and basic empathy is not enough to deter people from being racist, but their football team not picking up 3 points is. And that is, it's a shocking truth of the world, but it seems like that might be the only course of action. You think that the plan might be slightly flawed because it could be manipulated very easily. I do agree with that. I'd like to hear your take on it in a second, but where do we stand with this? Because it just feels like there's a never-ending problem.
It's a constant cycle that we're going around. It's just continuous, isn't it? And it is difficult to kind of figure out, I think, a plan of action, how we're actually going to tackle these issues. Actually, like you mentioned, forfeiting the games. Is that on the basis of a large portion of the fans in the stadium, obviously showing these racist behaviours and towards the players, or is that for individuals, or is it's really difficult how you're gonna calculate that? I get at the end of the day, it shouldn't be tolerated at all. It's disgusting to see. I saw the clips of the Sheffield Wednesday game as well, of the fan, obviously Casey Palmer, obviously brought it to the referee's attention, which is really good to see. Like it's that's should be done. Players shouldn't be having to just ignore it and just suffer that sort of, torment, really. The games should be being suspended and play should be brought to a halt, whether that's games that are spent just, the games are abandoned and played another day, and obviously take action against the individuals who are just stupid enough to act the way that they are doing. And it's just frustrating, isn't it? Because it's something we feel like it's tiring in a way that it's a depressing subject. It really is. To continue to have to talk about it and acknowledge that there's this sort of behaviour still in the game, and that's something that needs to be rectified, like you mentioned, for educating, people at a very young age. And I think one of the things that it's not monitored enough in is on social media. I feel like that's something that's not policed well enough.
Yeah, of course
I
not.
just think it's so easy to target players and individuals, and it just happens every day. That's the sad thing about it. Happens every day on there, and obviously in matches, obviously let's be honest, it could happen to a player maybe once or twice a season potentially. But
I think way more.
these players who are so, engaged with the outside world and those who are watching football every day, get to see this on their mobile phones every single day, which is the awful thing, really.
Yeah, and the thing is, like before we were recording, Mike and I were talking about this, and Mike said, "So Infantino saying this, does that mean he might be getting something right?" And the sad truth of it is, I'll believe it when I see it, and it feels like it's virtue signaling from FIFA, and they're saying something because they need to be seen saying something. But we've been talking about this for so long; nothing's changing. FIFA at one point put together an anti-racism task force, which was eventually disbanded because they said that they'd solve the problem. Well, clearly you haven't. Serie A has been dealing with these kinds of attitudes for the longest time, and it feels like there it is particularly poignant. But it happens in this country too. We saw it at the weekend, like you mentioned, and it's devastating seeing that. And I feel really proud of players like Mike Maignan for taking that stand, because no human being should go to any workplace and be subjected to abuse. Now, the three of us, white British men, can talk about this matter and can only try and think about the impact that it's having on these players. It would be nice to get some other opinions on this and people closer to it, because I don't know what the answer is the honest answer. And I like the idea of penalising fans, because I think it's a criminal activity and they need to be penalised in the most severe way from a personal level possible. And I think the only benefit I see of forfeiting games for a team is that it incentivizes the clubs to do more in terms of helping police those matters and educating their fan bases. Because let's be honest, the majority of this racism is bred from ignorance that then turns hatred. And that's a horrible reality that exists in our game. And I feel like that's consistent across a lot of issues we're talking about at the moment, and the attitudes across fan bases. It's sad because you, myself, Mike, we come on here every week and talk about football with each other because we love football. We talk with our friends about it. We are highly engrossed in the game, and it feels like moments like this take it away from us. And it's really sad, but it was one that I didn't want us to ignore this week, and I don't think we ever will. And I'm glad of that. But weird note to end the show on. Obviously, we've got another game tomorrow. Brighton Wolves taking place on Monday. Mike introduced the show, but live recordings, anything can happen. Wherever you are right now, Mike, we look forward to recording again with you next week, mate. For now, me and Dave will say goodbye at least. Thank you for listening. If you're listening on the audio platforms, please make sure you head over to our YouTube channel where you can see shorthand clips from this week's pod on key content. Please give us a subscribe there. It's an excellent platform we're growing. And we love engaging with you as well. There's been some excellent comments over the last few weeks. We really appreciate the feedback and having football conversations with you. That's why we do this podcast, because we love talking about football. If you want to talk with us, great. Please do. You're really good. You can interact with us on socials as well, Football Diary UK. And we look forward to talking again next week, don't we, Dave?
Yeah, I'll see you next time. Stay safe out there. Wind's picking up by the sounds of it.
Yeah, enough to take Mike out of the recording. He's been literally blown away by the storm. So hopefully he's all right. We'll find him by next week. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us, guys.
See you next time.